This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking.
Hi, thanks for joining us at In Your Right Mind. My name is Stephanie Wilder-Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tanmay Sharma. I'm really pleased to welcome Stephanie to In Your Right Mind. Stephanie is an author, a stand-up comedian, a TV personality, a blogger, a mother of three daughters. I could go on and on. She's an author of five books. Sippy cups are not for Chardonnay, she writes. Apart from appearing in several television shows, she's also the parenting expert for NBC's The Today Show. As we go on, you will hear more and more about how she has contributed to the area of addiction treatment and her ideas of how we should be talking about it. So it's with great pleasure that I'm joined by my co-host, Stephanie.
Thank you so much. That was such a surprise. I didn't know I've even done all those things. Yes, I am so interested in all of these topics. I've been sober myself for over 8 years, and I try to help other people find their path to sobriety or not. But I love talking about this stuff. And today, this is an exciting topic for me. We're talking about the phenomenon of Americans turning to pills faster than ever to manage emotional issues. Obviously, modern antidepressants can literally be a lifesaver for some patients and restore quality of life for millions of others. So we're not saying that they're bad. But have drugs originally created to treat serious issues become a shortcut remedy for problems that fall more into the category of everyday life challenges than psychiatric disorders?
Well, you know, without question, there's been a huge spike in the use of prescription psychotropic drugs. We have about 5% of the population of the world in the U.S., and we consume, what, like 75% of the drugs that are available in the world.
It's crazy.
Yes, and these medications are designed to alleviate symptoms of depression, anxiety, attention deficit disorder, and other issues. Probably the most commonly used medication is the kind of antidepressants that we know as SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which include common drugs like Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, and similar brands that are created to treat a range of moderate to severe depressive symptoms. Over the years, they've come to treat everything from postmenopausal syndrome to social anxiety, both within label and off-label. By that I mean whether there is an indication given for or authorization given to treat that by the FDA, or doctors are treating this off-label as they're allowed to do so, to say, okay, I think this drug may help such a patient. But more than one in every 10 Americans are now estimated to be on SSRIs, and it's pretty clear that they're being used in an every broader sense, you know, every broader set of issues than ever. With us on the line is Dr. Daniel Carlett, MD. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine and is the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report. I remember reading the report many, many years ago, when it was more controversial in terms of when these medications had just come out in the early mid to late 80s. It's a monthly newsletter on psychopharmacology, widely read by psychiatrists and nurses in the United States and abroad. I was practicing in Europe at that time. And Dr. Carlett is also the author of the book Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelation About a Profession in Crisis. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Carlett. I know you've seen a dramatic rise in the use of antidepressants. What do you think is the cause of this and the potential downside?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. Yeah, it's a really important topic. I think, as you said, more and more people are using these medications. And one of the reasons that I wrote about it was I saw a statistic that going from 1996, 13 million Americans were on antidepressants, and only about 10 years later, in 2005, that figure had doubled to 27 million. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, but you had mentioned one of them, which is that we have these new types of medications, the Prozac kinds of medications. Prozac first came out in 1988, and whereas it's really not more effective than any of the older medications, it had, at least it seemed to have, fewer side effects. We can get back to that in a minute, but seemed to have fewer side effects. So as psychiatrists were armed with these medications with apparently fewer side effects, books like Peter Kramer's Prozac, forget the title of it, but he came out with a book right around then.
Prozac Nation, I think it's.
Prozac Nation?
Listening to Prozac.
Oh, okay.
Came out. That was one of the earlier books. And people were reading that and coming to us and asking for this. And it's interesting. It was originally approved for depression, but now Prozac and Zoloft and other drugs like that are approved for over 10 different conditions, including various anxiety disorders and even for things like fibromyalgia. So we have a lot of patients coming to us wanting them. We have a series of financial incentives that make it easier for us to get paid, quite frankly, by the insurance companies if we have patients coming in for brief visits. So I think there are some positives, but then there are also some negatives with people taking these meds.
I have a question. Speaking as somebody who was on Zoloft for many years, I had no idea how difficult it was going to be to get off the drug. So after I had a baby, I was having some postpartum anxiety, depression. I was given Zoloft. I went on it. And, you know, after I felt like I was feeling better, I tried to get off of it. And I went, you know, according to the doctor, and went from 50 to 25 to off, and promptly had a panic attack. Went right back on, and then stayed on it for years and years and years because it was just too hard to get off.
Yeah, and that's something that is so common. I mean, with the patients that I treat, I keep hearing that kind of story over and over again. And I think that's one of the things that we didn't realize, meaning psychiatrists, we were prescribing these meds, and often people would come back and say, I feel so much better, I sort of feel like myself again. But we didn't realize that people are not going to get off these medications, and they're going to stay on them for a long time. And then what happens with the serotonin is that they're called SSRIs. They're serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So that means that the serotonin neurons are producing serotonin in our brain, and the medications are making it so that the serotonin does not get degraded, so that more and more of it builds up, which may or may not be the reason that it works. But what that causes is it means that the serotonin neurons are downregulated, and that means that they sort of become more quiescent. They feel like, oh, we don't have to make as much serotonin because there's this drug that's keeping it around. So then when you get off of the drug, you're operating in life, you're working, you're parenting with a brain that's sort of deadened in some way, downregulated. So it becomes very difficult for some people to sort of feel normal, to feel happy in a normal way. And then for others to have these very strange, we call them, it's not really withdrawal, but we call them discontinuation symptoms. And they can go on for weeks or months or sometimes even years.
Yeah, I had that for a long time, and I had to and I thought I was the only one. I started looking at it on the internet, but I had to go off of it so slowly that it seemed crazy. I mean, I had to cut it in half and then cut it in another half and then take, by the end of it, I was just a little bit of like dirt from the pill, taking it just to avoid feeling panicky.
Well, this is a really important topic in terms of Serotonin and withdrawal symptom. We're coming up to a break, and so let us go through this in the next segment. So we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, let's talk about withdrawal from serotonin and what we should do.
And we'll also talk about prescribing these medications for kids.
Okay.
Want to get the latest information regarding mental illness, substance abuse, and more? Then get hooked on Hook Sober, a group of sobers who have been hooked on updating you with the latest trends regarding behavioral health and addiction. Want to check them out? Go to HookedSober.com. That's HookedSober.com. And get hooked, because recovery is possible in all cases.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind. We've been talking to Dr. Daniel Carlat, author of Unhinged, and joining us now on the line is pediatrician Dr. Peter Schulman. Dr. Schulman is a graduate of Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He completed his pediatric internship and residency at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and he's a board-certified fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And bonus, he's also my kid's doctor. Dr. Schulman, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience with diagnosing and prescribing these psychotropic medications in your practice?
All right. Well, let's break it into two categories. One, if you're talking attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, yes, we prescribe a lot of medication for attention deficit disorder, I individualize the case to determine if they need it. As I always say, need is a relative term. But if clearly the child is having attentional issues, focusing issues, distractibility issues, and it's significantly affecting self-esteem and self-confidence, then it is appropriate to talk about using medication.
You know, Dr. Schulman, if I may talk about him like he's not here, is a super down-to-earth, grounded, reasonable pediatrician. But I want to ask you about this. There was this 2014 article in Esquire magazine that says 1 in 7 boys is diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, and many of those boys will be prescribed a drug to deal with the symptoms. And I want to ask both of you, Dr. Schulman and Dr. Carlat, what's up with that?
Boy, that figure, I can only speak from the experience of my practice. That would be much higher than the rate at which I prescribe it. I can't imagine it's anywhere near that high. I couldn't even fathom, I guess, 1 in 30? I don't know, but it's certainly not 1 in 7. And, yes, we use it for girls, too. So, I would say boys more than girls. If a child really has attention deficit, is there other therapy that can work? In my opinion, no. But that doesn't mean you have to use medication.
Well, how can you tell the difference? Dr. Carlat, you were telling me about a book by a pediatrician about Tom Sawyer, ADD.
Yeah, this is a book. I recommend people read it, doctors and consumers. It's called Running on Ritalin. It's by Larry Diller, who's a behavioral pediatrician. But I was talking to him about this for one of my issues, the Carlisle Report, and he was saying, you know, I think that there are some kids who have actual legitimate ADHD, but then there's some that have Tom Sawyer ADHD. And I kind of stopped and said, well, that's something you don't hear every day. And he said, no, there are these children, often boys, who may not do particularly well in schoolwork, may have interests that are different from what adults around them wish they were interested in. But when they do find something that they like to do, they focus like a laser beam. You know, like they're able to focus on video games or something like that. And he was saying there was no doubt in his mind that Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, if they were alive today or if they had never been alive, would have the diagnosis of ADHD and would be put on Ritalin, which I thought was kind of telling. I think that goes along with what Dr. Schulman was saying, that really I think these figures of 15% of kids having it are really inflated and have to do with some of the methods that are used to assess the prevalence, which aren't always very accurate.
Well, that's what I was coming on to, this whole thing about how do we assess and how do we diagnose that, being selectively good at something sounds more like an autism spectrum disorder rather than ADHD. So coming back to this issue of, are we assessing ADD or ADHD in the right way? And
are some kids just bored at school? Is what we're asking. Are some kids being brought in? Listen, this kid can't concentrate in school. I mean, I know this from my own kids. One of my kids, the teacher told me, like, maybe you should take him to the pediatrician and have him looked at. He really can't focus. Well, he couldn't focus because he was bored. And then she gave him some harder work to do, and suddenly he was challenged and he could focus. I'm not saying this is true for all kids at all. I'm sure many of them have an actual issue. But that's a really good question, Dr. Sharma. How do you tell who's actually suffering from ADD or ADHD and who's just bored?
Well, the sort of medicalization of life. You've got two experts in there where they have their practices. And I'm sure that we'll hear a little bit about this in terms of where does normality end and then psychopathology begin?
There's no absolute answer to that. I can tell you from my individual practice, let's say parents come in and report the attentional issues that we're talking about. There is formal testing that one can do, although I am generally not in favor of that formal testing because it's very expensive and often doesn't give us more information than a clinical history will reveal. The luxury I have is that I've known most of these kids since birth, so I get a feeling over the years that there may be attentional issues. It's not as if it comes just out of the blue. That's the luxury of having seen these kids on a longitudinal basis over years. I can get a feeling over these years which way we're going. I'm not saying they all need medication, but it is something to discuss.
No,
what
no.
I am against is all these cottage industries that have sprung up for the so-called treatment of ADD, like the Drake Institute, biofeedback. Those have no role.
Dr. Schulman, I know that from personal experience how conservative you are about your treatments, but I have a question, which is, do you find that some parents come in feeling pressured by their school to put
Absolutely.
Their kids on a drug?
Absolutely. And that I resist. The school teacher may say, you should talk to your doctor about starting medication. Never, no teacher, no school should ever say that. They can say your child is having problems. You can talk to your pediatrician about that. But they can't say, talk to your child about medication. And yes, especially in these high-powered schools here in L.A., private and public, yes, there is a push for all the kids to do well, for cookie-cutter kids. In that sense, you're right.
It's as if we want to legitimize any, problem that is there with a medical diagnosis and then with medication. But that seems to be the problem. I remember years ago, the BBC called me for a comment and they said, well, there's this new thing that GSK has brought out. This is a pill for shyness. So sertraline had just been indicated. There was an indication for sertraline for social anxiety. So the media called it a pill for shyness. So it showed how, they call it green grassing. I think it's extension of the symptomatology. So how SSRIs went from depression right till social anxiety. And I don't know, maybe Dr. Carlett will have more information on how that you know, maybe 5% of the population have that. So you may have social anxiety, but then you need to have SSRIs to be able to cope with that. I wonder, Dr. Carlett, whether you have any comments on that.
Yes, well, there's a definite phenomenon of what we call the medicalization of normal feelings and normal behaviors. I remember there was a New Yorker cartoon where a patient was coming to his psychiatrist and said, doctor, could we up the dose? I still have feelings. I think that kind of thing happens sometimes. You know, we talked earlier about coming off of medication. It becomes very confusing when we have lots and lots of people on anxiety and depression medications. It becomes confusing what's normal, what's a normal mood, and what's an abnormal mood. And when you talk about ADHD and stimulants, you also have to factor in a complication, which is that stimulants are diverted. They're a drug of abuse. They make people feel energetic and sort of high and happy. One study that was done in Canada of 280 college students who came to a clinic saying they thought they had ADHD symptoms, when they actually did the interview, only 5%, only 14 of them actually qualified. But all the others had come either because they wanted the medication because their friends were doing better and they wanted to do better in school, or maybe they had concentration and focus issues that had nothing to do with ADHD but had to do with anxiety or depression or stress that was going on in their lives.
And aren't there some kids that are trying to fake symptoms of ADD?
You know, there's actually websites that you can go on that are called how to convince my shrink to give me Adderall. And as Dr. Shulman said, there's no objective test for ADHD. Although there are companies that are trying to sell computerized testing, the data isn't very good for those. It's basically you sit down. We sit down with our patients and we ask them questions about how they're functioning. And if they want us to believe that they have a diagnosis in order to get a medication, it's pretty easy for them to do that.
Right.
Yeah, I have it a little bit differently because I'm talking to the parents as much as the child. So I'm not dealing so much with the college age kids who are on medication, or if they are college age on medication, they've been on medication prior to college. So it's a little bit different.
Well, we need to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk more about this, about these measures some people take to get their meds and more. You're listening to In Your Right Mind on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297 or online at sovhealth.com.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Getting support from friends online kept me on track.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
Instead of smoking after I ate, I'd get up and take a walk.
I missed having a cigarette in my hand, so I'd hold a pen or a straw, anything.
Until I knew I wouldn't give in to temptation, I spent more time with my friends who didn't smoke.
I went to places that were smoke-free.
I didn't stay quit the very first time I tried.
I kept on trying, and I learned something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
I quit.
I quit.
I quit.
We did it. So can you.
You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
How would you like to win $500 for doing what you're doing now?
What? Picking my nose in traffic?
No, you idiot. Listening to KABC.
Makes more sense.
The high-low game is back starting Monday. Listen for the cue to call between 6 and 6. If you're caller 7 and give us the lucky number, we'll give you $500 cash.
Now that's what I call picking a winner.
Plus, win or lose, get a $40 gift card to Barney's Beanery just for playing. That's $540 more reasons to listen to the louder, clearer, and very generous 790 KABC.
Hi, we're back with In Your Right Mind, talking about the pill problem. Are we medicating our moods? We're here with Dr. Carlat, the author of Unhinged. We're talking to Dr. Peter Schulman, my kid's pediatrician. And Dr. Sharma is here, and I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. And we're talking about the widespread use of drugs like antidepressants and ADD meds. And we're wondering if too many people are taking them for the wrong reasons or if they're necessary. So how can we tell, you know, whether a patient genuinely has, say, clinical depression or whether they have a situational issue like grieving a breakup or they got fired from their job? And are medications appropriate in both cases?
Well, I think we are, you know, at Sovereign, for example, we treated over 15,000 people over the last 5 years or so. We're looking, and we're a behavioral health organization. Our MDs and PhDs tell us that there's a large percentage of people that come to us looking for help for day-to-day problems, and we can deal with that from a talking therapy perspective. Some of them need medication. I don't think I want to minimize the fact that these medications save lives. If you have severe depression, you need to be treated, and you cannot get through to somebody in a talking therapy on if they are severely, they've got what is known as psychomotor retardation, and and they really need medication. However, if you have mild depression, for example, or mild anxiety, one needs to see whether this person really needs to be medicated. And that's a clinical decision that needs to be taken by the psychologist, the therapist, the psychiatrist, whoever that is. But the incentive, as Dr. Carlett had mentioned, the incentive nowadays is because a large percentage of people are on insurance, one type or the other, a very small percentage private pay, is for to do things quickly. Mm-hmm. And so there is an incentive for, let's write this prescription and be done with it. And then you know that you're going to get paid. However, to justify a longer amount of time with the patient is much more difficult. So, and I think that that's where you have the problem that, and also, it's easier to do that than to say, well, no, I don't think you have a problem. I think you need to be talking to somebody instead. So our culture is such that there is this, you legitimize, you make something legitimate, if you like, by having, by taking a pill. Now that you're taking a pill, you have a disorder.
Right.
So because you have a disorder. So the question then arises, are we, being happy, unhappy? Are we not allowed to be sad? Are we not allowed to be happy? If you're too happy, there's a problem. Where are the borders of normality?
Right. And Dr. Carlett, you were saying too that, that one of the problems is, as a psychiatrist, is you can prescribe the medications, but then you can't talk to the people. You don't have the time to, a lot of psychiatrists don't get to do the talk therapy anymore.
Well, it can be a really big problem, Stephanie. I had shared to you earlier this study that showed that the percentage of visits to psychiatrists that included any psychotherapy dropped from 44% of those visits from in 1997 to 29% in 2005, and I think it's even less now. So Dr. Sharma's point is spot on about that there are these financial incentives. We tend to do more medicating than we should. But I'm actually torn a bit on this issue because on the one hand, I think that we have to, as psychiatrists and primary care doctors who do a lot of prescribing, I think we do have to be, careful about not prescribing too many of these Prozac-type medications. I think we have to look at the symptoms of depression. We have to look at, there's actually 9 different criteria that we have to use, and if a patient meets 5 of those 9, including problems like suicidality, poor sleep, difficulties with concentration, with appetite, then if they have to meet those criteria, they should get a medication. But on the other hand, I've seen so many patients who have what I would, term kind of common unhappiness do well on medications. And I even shared in my book some of my own personal experiences. About 10 years or so ago, I had a situation where I had accepted a job. We were going to move, and then our plans changed at the last minute. And I began to have this kind of stuck feeling. And I just felt very, I wouldn't say I felt depressed. I just felt kind of unhappy. I wasn't suicidal or anything. And, being a doctor, I had plenty of samples, and I decided to take a pill called Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. And within 48 hours, I felt almost euphoric. Now, that didn't last. But over the years, I continued to take it off and on. What that told me, and I think it's interesting for doctors sometimes to take the medications that they prescribe, not always, but in this case it was instructive, because what it told me is that there really are patients who don't meet all the actual criteria that we see in DSM-5 for a condition, who can get better. And I think that's one of the reasons that we have the such a high rate. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who feels unhappy should run out and ask for a medication, because there were certainly, side effects that I had, and I had, just like you, Stephanie, I had difficulty getting off of the medication. I think that we also shouldn't go the opposite direction and say that only if a patient has, an actual FDA-labeled indication should we prescribe that medication, because sometimes it can work for surprising numbers of people.
When I, after I had a baby and was experiencing the postpartum, maybe it took about a year of having these symptoms before I was prescribed Zoloft, and it really worked. I mean, you know, I'm pro pills if you have something going on. And then years later, when I finally got off of it, as I described, my husband, if I was being especially irritable, would be like, maybe, you know, you need to get back on Zoloft. I was like, no, having three kids can make you irritable. Like, that's normal. You can't send me off to go on an antidepressant just because I'm feeling a little bit irritable. You got to put up with it. You're married to me.
Well,
right. I mean, there's probably not enough Zoloft in the world to allow people to deal with some of these situations.
Yes, but when you're talking about postpartum depression, that is an interest of mine, and I think pediatricians are well-placed to recognize it. Now, pediatricians and hospitals are actually having new moms fill out a questionnaire to evaluate if they are showing signs of postpartum depression, because, as you know, it can be absolutely debilitating, and it can hit a mother who has no prior history of depression, and it's really, it's like being hit by a truck. It can be so bad.
Yeah, and it's very startling for women, too, because some women have had no history of depression,
right,
and then they have a baby, and they don't even know what this is that they're feeling. They just think, well, I'm supposed to be happy. I just had a baby. Why am I not happy? And then they blame themselves, and they are not able to recognize that these are symptoms of anxiety and depression.
Exactly. They have no framework, no frame of reference to understand what's happening to them. And that's why I think pediatricians are well-placed to make sure that the mothers, not only the babies are doing fine, but the mothers are doing fine, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you're listening to In Your Right Mind, talk radio. Serotonin does make you happy, or at least gets your mood up, whether it's chocolates or whether it's any other method of increasing serotonin. So it should be expected that irrespective of whether we achieve diagnostic criteria or not, that we should be, that even subtherapeutic doses should make a difference. So it's logical that if anybody is unhappy, that any amount of elevation of serotonin would help. The question then is that when you balance the risk benefit ratio as to whether the benefit of taking the medication is balances out with the risk of either getting off of it or any side effects that might be there. And it might be well worth it. So, and I think, there are personal experiences that we've heard on this show, and it is really, really worth it. And other times it is a slight problem. And I think that it's really horses for courses, that what is needed is an assessment, I think, rather than just demanding a pill. And it depends on the person that is at the other end, and the psychiatrist, the pediatrician, the family practitioner, whoever it is at the other end, saying, well, what is the issue? And irrespective of the diagnosis as to whether they feel that person would benefit from the medication and how long they should be on that medication.
All good
and
points.
One of the issues, Dr. Sharma, is that we really don't have, psychiatrists and primary care physicians, really don't have the kind of time, or we're not taking the kind of time necessary to educate our patients about side effects or to ask them about side effects. And I remember expert who was telling me about studies that he had done. He said that in one study, patients on antidepressants reported 20 times more side effects than were recorded by psychiatrists that were interviewed about those patients. We're just not asking about them
sometimes not warning about them. And with serotonin in particular, the two side effects I think that my patients complain of the most bitterly are, number one, sexual dysfunction, yes, and number two, drowsiness. Those are the two. And those can be things that cause people to go off of their medications in order to get over those side effects. But then you can risk having either discontinuation or a resumption of the original symptoms. So it becomes very difficult. But again, I think the key thing is to educate patients, tell them, you know, this could be medication you're going to take for the long haul, which is great if it works, but here are potential side effects that you're also going to have for the long haul.
Yeah.
And not to tell them because we're afraid they're not going to take their meds.
We need to take one more break, but when we come back, I find this part of the conversation fascinating. We're going to talk about more about side effects and about alternatives, other things that we can do to feel better. You're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor, Dr. Schulman, and Dr. Carlett, and we're going to be right back. In Your Right Mind, Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or online at sovhealth.com.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
I'm Tiffany. I have some tips for you on how to quit smoking like I did. First, I did some reading about it. I found a lot of great advice on how to quit smoking and picked out the ways I thought would work best for me. I started by setting a quit date. Then I threw out my ashtrays, lighters, and matches. I did other things too, like exercising more, and it worked. But I'd still get cravings, especially on long car rides. To help me with that, I put a picture of my mother in my car. She died of lung cancer from smoking cigarettes when I was only 16. Now I have a 16-year-old daughter. That picture of my mother reminds me that I don't want to miss all the things my daughter is going to do in her life, including turning 17.
You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Wake up with Doug McIntyre in the morning.
You know
Fred, the other day we bought a case of paper towels from an online vendor.
Why?
Because they could.
There's only 7,000 places within 50 feet of our house where we can get paper towels, but instead, paper towels are being taken off a shelf on a forklift, put on a truck, flown halfway across the country, put on another truck, and driven to our place. For paper towels! Carbon footprint, anyone?
McIntyre in the morning.
Now with Leanne tweeting news. 5 to 10 on KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind. We are talking about the pill problem. Are we over-medicating our moods? Continuing with us right now is a pediatrician, Dr. Peter Schulman, author of Unhinged, Dr. Daniel Carlett, Dr. Sharma, and myself. We were talking about side effects of medications, and before I ended up on Zoloft, I took Lexapro for one night, and I went into a little manic. I got manic. I thought I felt great, but I called my mom at midnight and I said, I'm feeling so much better. And she's like, do not ever take that drug again.
There you go.
Are there things that people are told to be aware of in case of certain reactions to certain drugs? Because I've heard of this happening to other people before, having a weird reaction to a drug.
Go ahead. Personally, it was said that we don't warn our patients about side effects. I always warn them. I'm always there if there are side effects. They can either email me or call me. And when we see the patients on medication regularly, and I always ask about side effects. So at least with kids, I don't know that that claim is true, that we don't ask about side effects.
Oh, I'm not saying we don't ask, but I think I wasn't thinking that that was going to be a side effect. Do you tell people, like, you shouldn't feel too good too fast? It's not working right.
Tell patients if it is, I give them a broad-based understanding. I say, if it makes you feel in ways you're not comfortable feeling, you must call me or email me.
That's good advice. I'm wondering also about alternatives to these medications, and I'm especially interested for kids. You know, what are some things that kids can try before they go to meds? I know for my daughter who was suffering from anxiety, we did some meditation, and that worked really well for her. Are there any things that you know that work, or any alternative treatments?
With anxiety in particular, that does respond well to therapy. If I may interject personally, you had an amazing therapist, though, and I wish that was the case throughout the community, that we had therapists as skilled as you had. That isn't always the case.
She was pricey.
Yeah, but therapy can really make a difference. Relaxation techniques to teach kids to cope and compensate with their anxiety. That can be used, at least on a short-term basis, with medication so that the therapy is more effective.
But one of the issues is that most people cannot afford pricey therapists, and most people that come for treatment to organizations like Sovereign Health are on insurance and this so-called evidence-based treatment that is required really is either cognitive behavior therapy or medication, really. So you can't, they dismiss equine therapy as experimental. They will dismiss meditation, yoga as experimental treatments. So, in fact, they disqualified one of our sites as a site because we offered equine therapy at that site. So they said, oh, this is one of these high-flying sites. We are not even going to allow patients to go
there.
Isn't
that proven to work? I mean, especially yes. With kids with autism? That's a big therapy they use.
Yes, except that they say, well, it wasn't a treatment for autism. It was generally for depression and you know, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. But my point is that it takes the majority of the people, since the Affordable Care Act, have got access to insurance, and somehow for the the majority of people, it is they are bound by they're limited to very few treatments, and maybe, you know, treatments like TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I'm wondering, Dr. Carlett, whether you have any thoughts on that for adults, at least, whether there are any other, you know, avenues apart from medication for adults.
You mentioned, the psychotherapies. And by the way, if insurance companies are really severely limiting patients, that's illegal at this point, because we now have a parity law, a federal healthcare parity law that was passed that says that mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment have to be treated in the same way by insurance companies as any other treatment. So that's just as an aside. The treatment of choice for many psychiatric conditions, and this is true if you ask any psychiatrist, isn't just some radical, guy who published a book about it, saying this. The treatment of choice for many conditions now is psychotherapy. So the treatment of choice for post-traumatic stress disorder is exposure therapy. For chronic insomnia, by far the most effective treatment is cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. And you can really go down the line and tick off many, many psychotherapies, and there are many, many techniques out there now. But it is true, even if your insurance covers it, sometimes it's hard to find a really qualified therapist. But if you go online, you can often find someone who practices a certain type of therapy in your area.
But a lot of those therapists don't take insurance. That's the problem.
Yeah, it can be a problem.
And it's cash paying. And then you submit it and get reimbursed X amount. So it becomes expensive, almost prohibitive.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma, and we're talking about the need for psychotherapy to go along with a lot of these prescription drugs. I've heard it said that the drugs are like scaffolding to help keep you stable so that you can actually do the therapy. So is it ever okay to just take the drugs and not talk about what's going on?
Well, I have patients who do quite well, just on drugs without therapy. But the scaffolding thing, I think, is a really good analogy. I'm thinking now of a patient that I put on a combination of a couple of different medications for pretty severe depression that was preventing him from leaving his house. And once he started to get better, he's been starting to do something. It's his own version of therapy, kind of unorthodox. But what he does is every morning for an hour, he spends time in the grocery store. He doesn't buy anything, but he just goes in. And it's part of, we would call it behavioral activation in our cognitive behavior jargon. But he goes in there and spends an hour a day, and he has social contact, and he sees colorful things. And that combined with medication has been sort of a godsend for him. So we have, a lot of different, I think the key word is creativity.
Well,
being creative with our approaches.
I think that's a really great ending note. That's all the time we have. I want to thank Dr. Daniel Carlett so much. Thank you so much. And Dr. Peter Schulman, my pediatrician. And if you like what you hear, you can listen into In Your Right Mind by going to our website at inyourrightmind.com, or download In Your Right Mind as a podcast by going to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Dr. Sharma, for having me on this excellent show, providing excellent information. In fact, next week, we're going to be talking about alcohol and the teenage brain with our special guest, Dr. Anthony Mealy and Robin Reiser. So join us next Sunday, 5 p.m., 790 KABC Talk Radio.
This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.